This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. We call our show Main Street because these microphones are our virtual Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And we've got the real ones where people greet each other and talk about their news and share their opinions, talk about what's on their minds, maybe talking these days about budgets, federal and state. You know, they set priorities about how we spend our money to deliver the most good. And sometimes we have to wrestle with difficult issues. We live in a wealthy nation, as we all know, and we live in a state that exports food to the world. But hunger persists virtually everywhere in this country. The Great Plains Food Bank provides food assistance across North Dakota, and the extent of its operation and the numbers of people served is powerful evidence of the prevalence of hunger. Steve Sellent is the CEO of the Great Plains Food Bank. Recently, he sat down with Matt Olean for the Prairie Pulse television show.
Steve, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Great to be with you.
What is the Great Plains Food Bank? What's its mission?
So we are the largest hunger relief organization in the state of North Dakota and the only food bank, and our mission is to end hunger through community partnerships. And we really do that in two major ways. One, we're the major provider of food supplies for a network of 215 food pantries and other charitable feeding programs in 113 communities. We provide about 75% of all the food used by every charitable feeding program in the state. And then we also operate 8 different programs focused on childhood hunger, rural hunger, senior hunger, and help out in times of disaster.
Mm-hmm. And how much food is distributed per year, Steve, and where are the areas of need that you serve?
So we distributed food for just under 11 million meals last year. And to put that in perspective, that's enough food to feed everybody in the city of Fargo, roughly 120 residents, one meal a day for the next 3 months. So, you know, we have a warehouse that can hold 53 semi-loads of food, so we're a big warehousing and transportation operation as well as a hunger relief organization.
Where do you get the food from?
Almost 95% of the food for those 11 million meals is donated, and the vast majority comes from hundreds of food industry partners. Everything from, a pasta manufacturer giving us a load of noodles to perishable food picking up from grocery stores, dozens of them across the state every single day. And that's just a couple examples.
Mm-hmm. Who qualifies for food distribution, Steve? I know that's a question I hear a lot.
Yeah. So we serve any nonprofit agency that works with low-income people, people with hunger needs. You know, when it comes to the individual, in a nutshell, it's really anybody that doesn't have the means to provide the nutritional assistance that they need. So sometimes there's really strict guidelines for our programs, income guidelines. Other times it's a teacher identifying a student in the class just because of behavior.
Yeah, tell us about the backpack program.
I think the big thing there is, you know, kids get free breakfast and lunch meals during the week, and we learned that they were going hungry on the weekend, coming back to school Monday, and they weren't learning as well. There was classroom behavior problems. So we started the backpack program to provide a bag of food on Friday afternoons to help kids get through the weekend. And we didn't know how big this was going to get. We started with a couple schools in West Fargo. Now we serve 32 schools in the Fargo-Moorhead area, about 1,200 kids. And statewide, we serve over 3,500 backpacks every Friday afternoon in about 40 communities in North Dakota.
Have you seen the needs increase over the years, Steve, or not?
You know, there hasn't been too many years where we haven't seen an increase. And, you know, in the last decade in particular, we've seen the number of food shelf visits almost triple from 55,000 to more than 170,000 a year. And part of that is, you know, more people needing help. Part of it is people needing more help. You know, their costs have gone up faster than their income. And I think a large part of it, though, has been everybody involved in the fight against hunger in our community really trying to expand our services and our reach so we have less people that are struggling with hunger.
How about around the state? Where do you see the needs greatest there, Steve?
A lot of people think that, you know, there'd be lesser needs in the rural areas.
Right.
We did a study a couple years ago, and we found out there was 29 underserved counties in our state, and almost every one was a rural county because the food assistance services just aren't available out there. So we've been working really hard on that, had some great success in turning that around. But, you know, percentage-wise, there are more people in the urban communities that seek help, but certainly delivering services is much more challenging in the rural areas. And the greatest food insecurity rates are still on our Native American reservations.
Sure.
So that's an area that we put a lot of focus on.
And do you find in the rural areas, Steve, it's this kind of rural poverty issue that sort of people don't realize it actually exists, but it does?
You know, I think poverty and hunger is so well hidden, you know, in our state here in North Dakota, and people don't, you know, just don't see that. And I didn't see that before I got into the food banking industry. But it's there. You know, you look at our poverty rates, you look at our income rates and everything else that, you know, to be honest, we're doing a little better than most states, and we've had some great years. But there's still over 90,000 people in our state that are turning to the Great Plains Food Bank and our services for help. One out of every nine people in North Dakota and Clay County, Minnesota, and over 50% of them, are almost 50%, are children and seniors. So there's just a tremendous amount of hidden need in our state.
Do you get concerned, like with the current legislative session, a lot of budget talks, you know, the money's not coming in like it used to, and with the trickle-down impact that that could have on people?
Absolutely. You know, anything that affects housing, wages, health care, all those things are part and parcel of people that struggle with hunger. So cuts in those areas are probably going to result in more people turning to us for help.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you about disaster relief? Because I know you guys do swing into action when things like that happen. We haven't had a flood in a while.
Yep.
That's good. But talk about that, too.
We're in a unique position in that we can access the nation's food industry, personal care industry, and cleaning supply industry in times of disaster through our national organization, Feeding America. So after the 97 floods, we brought in over 100 semi-loads of product that we worked with the American Red Cross and Salvation Army and our partner agencies and our programs to distribute. After the Minot floods a few years ago, we brought in over 20 semi-loads of product. So we have that access to huge amounts of product that we can then work with national and local organizations to distribute.
Okay, let's go through a few more of your programs.
The
mobile food pantry, what's that?
That is our take on the old bookmobile concept. Mm-hmm. And a lot of communities, especially smaller communities in the state, can't afford to have a brick-and-mortar food pantry. So we pack up the food boxes in our warehouse, put them on our truck, you know, go to a church parking lot or other site in that community, and then just actually distribute the boxes off the truck. We usually have the program operating in about 25 communities. I think the most amazing sight I ever saw is one time we had over 500 vehicles lined up waiting for our semi-tractor with those boxes of food on to arrive. So it's been a really well-received program, and there was certainly a lot of needs in those communities. Now in partnership, we're able to serve.
Okay, how about the Senior Food Pack Program?
That's actually a partnership between the USDA, which provides the food, the state of North Dakota, which administers us, and us at the food bank, which distribute the food. And it's food boxes tailored specifically to seniors. And often we really struggle to reach seniors because of sometimes it's pride, sometimes it's mobility, sometimes it's diet and all those other things. So this is a program where we can really tailor and meet the needs and reach seniors that our other programs don't meet.
Do you find that a big need around the state, especially in smaller towns?
It's a growing need. You know, our senior population's increasing, senior poverty's increasing. So I think you'll hear a lot more from us in the next 3-4 years as new ways to address that need.
And how about the kids' summer feeding program?
That's kind of similar to the backpack program. Again, kids don't get those free school breakfasts and lunches in the summer. So this is, in a way, a program to fill in for the school lunch program during the summer months. And some schools offer the meal program in the summer, but a lot don't. So what we do is we actually have sites in parks and at libraries and sometimes even at schools in low-income neighborhoods and just trying to make sure that those kids get some type of support through the summer as well as through the school year.
And I should ask, with the kids' programs, if someone thinks they will qualify for this, what is the process they should go through? Or if someone knows someone that they think will qualify, what is the first step they need to do with your organization?
Yeah, in the Kids Summer Lunch Program in particular, we just operate that in low-income neighborhoods. So any kids in those neighborhoods within specific boundaries are eligible. Our other programs really do vary just depending on the program and the guidelines. And, you know, if somebody's in need, we're going to find a way to serve them. If somebody's going hungry, we're going to put food on the table, doesn't matter what.
Okay. And what is SNAP, Steve?
SNAP is a Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It's the biggest federal nutrition program, and people wonder, well, what do we have to do with that? And, you know, we did some research 7 or 8 years ago, and we found out that a lot of our people were still missing meals, going hungry, because there's just not enough food to go around. And we also found out that a lot of them were eligible but not taking advantage of the SNAP program. So we partnered with the Department of Human Services for 8 or 9 years now to make sure that people in our state that are going hungry and might be, you know, getting services some places, but just not enough. They're falling into a gap, know about all the eligible services, and can take advantage of those. So it'll take everybody to solve hunger, and everybody's got a role. And it just makes sense for the charitable sector and the government sector to partner and intersect where we can to make sure that we're meeting the needs of those kids, seniors, and families.
You know, I'm sure there are stories out there of people taking advantage of programs, but can you talk about maybe some misunderstandings with that as well, just that there's maybe not as much abuse going on as sometimes gets reported in the media or is spouted by various people?
Yeah, and it's, you know, most of it's anecdotal, and we hear those stories as well. Our philosophy is we would rather have one person that's taking advantage of the program than 99 not coming to the programs, because our guidelines are so strict, our bureaucracy is so big. We think it's really small. I've been doing this for 27 years. I've seen very few cases of it personally. So we do what we can. I mean, it's very important that people are donating that food to us, and it's very important that we get that into the hands of the people that need it most. But at the same time, you know, we want to be respecting people. We want to be making sure that we're helping them. And if we make it too hard for them to come, they're going to go without, and we're not going to do that.
You know, there's a lot of talk about the refugee resettlement program, especially in the Fargo area, both pro and con. Do you work with new Americans and new families that come in?
You know, we certainly do, both through our food pantries, and we have some food pantries that, you know, really work with those populations in particular. And for us, the main difference is sometimes, you know, we need to work on the type of foods that we provide because of their diets. It's not a huge part of the people we serve. We don't see it, you know, the percentage being any bigger, but we're all about serving anybody in need, no matter what the situation might be. So we just see that as part of our normal course of duties.
Do you think hunger and reaching out to people is always going to be an issue in this country?
It's kind of interesting because probably until the last year to 18 months, we did not, you know, we knew what our services were. We did not understand what the remaining need is. And there's been some new studies out there, and we've done a lot of work on that. And for the first time in my 27 years and our 34-year history as an organization, we actually kind of know where the finish line is. Okay. And that's really, really exciting. And part of that is because we've made such great strides over the last decade as we've tripled our services. So now we're really able to target in and focus, and we have set an organizational goal of reducing the missing meal gap by 50% over the next 5 years, which is so exciting. I never thought I'd see that while still with the food bank, and actually bringing an end to hunger by 2037 in the state of North Dakota.
Okay. Thanks, Steve, for being here.
Well, thank you so much. Yep. We really appreciate it.
That was Steve Sellin, CEO of the Great Plains Food Bank, talking with Matt Olean for Prairie Pulse. Coming up on Main Street, we'll have a survey about the equinox. This is the first day of spring.
To innovate, you must first start with an idea.
Anything is possible.
An engineering college in Lima designed a giant advertising billboard that absorbs air humidity and converts it into purified water.
Hi, this is Guy Raz, host of the TED Radio Hour on NPR. I'm inviting you to join me every Sunday here on Prairie Public.
In Silicon Valley, no one even takes you seriously unless you've had two failed startups. In other words, we're raising our girls to be perfect, and we're raising our boys to be brave.
Every week, we pick a theme, and we interview some of the greatest inventors, thinkers, writers, and artists from around the world.
If you analyze the skull and crossbones and Blackbeard's other design strategies like that, it's clear he was a very, very smart designer indeed.
People who've given TED Talks on technology, entertainment, and design.
If we start now, we can be ready for the next epidemic.
We examine fresh approaches to new problems, and we explore astonishing ways of thinking. Gilligan's Island, apparently it's one long parable. That's the TED Radio Hour, every Sunday at noon Central, 11 a.m. Mountain, on Prairie Public, with me, Guy Raz.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg. We're going to talk about the season we've just started.
Spring.
Yes.
Can you believe it? It's finally here.
I want to believe it.
Well, and I say that with such enthusiasm because, well, it has been shown that Americans are enormous fans of spring. What would you guess is the percentage of Americans who say they like spring?
And it would be an overwhelming majority because so few people really love winter.
It is 97% of Americans say that they are fans of spring, 61% claiming to love it, 36% saying they like it, only 2% claim to dislike it, and 1% hate.
Really?
Spring.
So these would be the people like me who maybe occasionally have an allergy or something like that. That would be my guess, because what else is there not to like about spring?
You know, I don't claim to get what the hatred is behind spring, but yeah, springtime allergies affecting roughly 1 in 4 Americans. So you're in good company.
I know I am, but I still like spring. So where does this come from, this survey, anyway?
We are getting this from nationaltoday.com. This is an organization. It actually comes out of Mandan by a guy named Marlo Anderson, and he puts together these National Day calendars, and you can sort of have, like, it's National Popcorn Day or it's National Bring Your Lunch to Work Day, things like that. And so he gave us some springtime facts.
Well, that prompted my memory when you said popcorn and Marlo Anderson, because I saw him at TEDx Fargo last summer. And he was talking about this National Day thing, which was kind of intriguing. And he was also talking about popcorn because they were related. He'd invented a day about popcorn.
So if you were going to invent a National Day, what would you try to get out there?
Wow, that's a good one. National. I don't know if I'd pick a food.
Wait, I don't think you have to. It could be National Give Your Cat to Ashley Day.
There you go. Or I would pick National Day Day. Let's just celebrate every day. Okay?
Well, how long are you going to keep up enthusiasm for that?
Well, until I lose enthusiasm, which is not a good thing if you're a human being. Now, this Marlo lives in Mandan, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. So he's got this business going, inventing days, I take it.
You know, it sounds like a weird idea. Like, well, I guess the same way that NPR and PBS sounds like a weird idea, we're going to put it out there and then see if people like it and support it. But I have seen so many people really get excited about, this is National Green Shoes Day or whatever. I may be making some of these up.
But apparently, he's kind of a tech guy. He's a guru. He's out there.
Yeah, he has the Guru of Geek podcast out there that's been picked up actually on some national publications too.
So what else did this survey indicate?
Well, here are the top 5 ways Americans plan to celebrate spring 2017. What do you think the number one is?
To celebrate spring.
With 15% of Americans saying they're going to start doing this.
Go outside.
Go outside. Okay, that's part of it. And what?
Walk.
Grill. Start grilling
outside.
That's
an even better idea. Way better idea.
14% of people say they plan to do a thorough house cleaning. So that comes in at number 2, spring cleaning. It makes sense. You know, I've talked to some people who work, you know, as self-care coaches and things like that, too, who talk about the seasons being a time of transition, of course, as winter gives way to spring. That is something that is a natural transition point that Mother Earth is going through. And talking about how people can mimic these sort of cycles and take advantage of that. And so spring cleaning continues to come in near the top of springtime activities. And rounding out the top 5, exercise outside. So there you go with your walking and other exercising. It does get muddy, so that'll go up, I'm sure, as spring turns to summer. Buy new clothes is number 10.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think there's a combination of sales and people just dying to get out of the house after the winter.
Put short sleeves
and
on.
And they're finally starting to lose the Christmas weight, you know, as they've started to exercise outside maybe done that thorough of a house cleaning. They got rid of all their old clothes.
3 weeks ago, I saw people wearing shorts just because they love the idea of it being in the 50s.
Well, yeah. Even I got pretty close to wearing shorts, and I tend to run cold. So, and then number 5, take your pet outside to enjoy the weather. 10% of people saying they plan on doing that to ring in spring. Do you have anything to add to the spring list?
Well, the spring list, what would I say? Well, I would say enjoy the fact that there is more sunlight, because I am sun-centric. I love the sun. Cloudy days, gloomy days kind of imprint me that way.
Yeah, I like to kind of joke that I am solar powered.
Oh,
myself.
There you go. Solar energy.
You know, and here's another interesting thing we think about for spring a lot of times too, especially elementary and college students. We talk about spring break a lot. And of course, among the college set, spring break tends to get very popular. Not so much as adults. Only 7% of Americans plan to take a spring break trip. And then another 6% plan to just take off time to enjoy the weather a little bit.
Well, that 7% of adults, I can cut this survey apart here, because that would be college and university students who are leaving en masse, and they probably represent about 7% of adults right now.
Well, yeah, that's a good point.
At any rate.
Surveys can always be digested and cut apart a little differently. So
it is spring.
It is.
So we'll just celebrate that for now.
I'm with you.
Okay.
Let's start grilling.
Okay, let's do that. And also, let's be reminded of some of the natural, physical nature of spring, because we have an expert about that in Chuck Lura. He is the author, of course, of Natural North Dakota. He's a biologist by training and profession. He teaches biology at Dakota College at Botineau. And today, he talks about one of the signs of spring.
Spring is in the air. It's on the calendar. And for me, one of the joys of spring is hearing the drumming of rough grouse in a Turtle Mountain aspen forest. As they say, love and marriage go together like a horse and carriage, so does aspen and rough grouse. Rough grouse rely heavily on aspen for both food and cover. As a result, most any area with extensive stands of aspen is likely to support some rough grouse. Here in North Dakota, rough grouse may be found in places such as the Turtle Mountains, Pembina Hills, and the aspen stands in J. Clark Salyer National Wildlife Refuge. But in many aspen stands, the sounds of grouse drumming is conspicuously absent in the spring. Grouse populations are known to be cyclic, taking around 10 years per cycle. But the quality of habitat for grouse is perhaps more significant in terms of the population densities within that 10-year cycle, and old decadent stands of aspen are poor grouse habitat. A variety of aspen of different age classes is required to provide optimum rough grouse habitat. Aspen stands up to about 10 years of age provide dense cover that provides the all-important protection for broods from predators, particularly avian predators. As a stand ages, change in the structure of the stand enhances winter cover and breeding cover. Finally, the older stands again provide winter cover and important food items, including aspen catkins and buds, highbush cranberry, rose fruits, willow, and hazel buds. However, these stands eventually become decadent, riddled with heart rot, toppled in winds, and along with other changes in the community, lose their attractiveness to grouse. In an aspen forest managed for rough grouse, the forest would probably look like a checkerboard, with blocks of aspen stands around 10 acres in size, harvested at staggered 10-year intervals on a 40-year rotation. The North Dakota Forest Service and Game and Fish Department occasionally cooperate on aspen management. It usually involves clearing blocks of aspen during the winter months to stimulate vigorous regrowth. The initial clearing may look like total devastation to the casual observer, but the aspen will resprout quickly and profusely, producing perhaps 40,000 stems per acre, and will soon provide quality habitat not only for rough grouse, but also deer, moose, and other game and non-game species. If you have the opportunity, walk through one of these young stands of aspen. Although the dense aspen might make it difficult to see wildlife, you'll likely see much more signs of wildlife, such as droppings, tracks, and browse twigs, than in an adjacent old-growth stand. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Botineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
Pretty evocative music too, isn't it? That's the theme from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, how that show opened for so many years. Fred Rogers endeared by young people and adults, frankly, their moms and dads everywhere. Well, he passed away not so long ago, but today would have been his 89th birthday. Happy birthday, Mr. Rogers. Coming up on Main Street, we'll talk about Women's History Month from the perspective of Mary Ann Talbot, and we'll go to the Fargo Film Festival. It starts this week. Matt Oline will give us a preview. But first, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Grafton is preparing for a worst-case scenario flood situation. The northeastern North Dakota city could see a near-record flood crest from the Park River. Police Chief Tony Domus.
We have declared an emergency. We are working with the Army Corps of Engineers to get the approval to begin elevating our dikes and building temporary levees. We've also got all of our city equipment maintained and stated in a single location and verified that everything is mechanically sound so that when the thaw comes, we are prepared to put the notification out for volunteers and have everybody respond to one location to start sandbagging.
Dumas says the Park River is a huge watershed and funnels water to the Red River from a number of tributaries at a point five miles west of Grafton. The volume of water, along with field runoff from rain-saturated soils last fall, has a very good chance of pushing a river crest in Grafton to more than 17 feet. In 1979, the river crested at more than 19.5 feet, flooding large parts of the city, including downtown. Dumas says depending on weather conditions, levee work, and stockpiling of sandbags, that could start early next week. A House committee will hold a hearing tomorrow on changes to the medical marijuana initiative passed by voters last November. The sponsors say the changes are needed to regulate it under North Dakota law. House Majority Leader Al Carlson.
The bill is in good shape. It's not an easy bill. It's got a lot of stuff in it. But it's I think we did the right thing's been done. And there's been a couple adjustments since the first go-around. The Attorney General Health Department have made some adjustments, and I think they're good ones. And we'll put those amendments on downstairs. And I think it's about ready to run.
A hearing will be held in the House Human Services Committee. Carlson says after the hearing, he will schedule an informational caucus on it with the goal of getting a two-thirds vote to make those changes. And nearly 9 out of 10 North Dakotans will file their state tax returns electronically this year. State Tax Commissioner Ryan Rauschenberger says some more complicated returns might have to be filed with paper forms, but for most, online is the way to go.
Better for the taxpayer, helps correct errors, it's easier to file. It actually helps you find certain credits and exemptions that you might not think of. So with all the smarts and the software these days, really helps taxpayers get as much of their money back as possible.
Rauschenberger says his office is focusing more on preventing fraudulent returns. Last year, they stopped about 1,400 phony files, which claimed more than $2 million. Rauschenberger says one of the best ways to prevent identity fraud is to file early and make sure your contact information is up to date. North Dakotans have until April 18th to file their 2016 state tax returns, the same as the federal tax deadline. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Indivisible is a live national conversation about America in a time of change.
If they were to completely drop the Affordable Care Act, I wouldn't be totally opposed to that as long as that pre-existing condition stayed in there.
As a country, we need to decide, do we care or do we not care? And if we don't care, just be honest about it.
I'm Kai Wright. Tune in or call in. Join us Monday through Thursday for the first 100 days of the new presidency. There's a seat at this table for everyone.
Indivisible airs Monday through Thursday evenings at 7 p.m. Central, 6 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Matt Olean, our resident film reviewer here at Main Street. And, of course, there's a big week ahead of us because he's also been one of the organizers of the Fargo Film Festival for several years, and that gets underway on Tuesday.
Yeah, we're excited, Doug. 17th year. It's grown a lot over the years. You've been a part of it as well, and we're very excited. A lot of filmmakers coming. A couple actors are coming that are attached to some of these films. We have the premiere of The Hero in Fargo, the Jeff Schlossman-produced film with Sam Elliott and Nick Offerman. That's going to be exciting on Friday night. We have the Fargo premiere of My Life as a Zucchini on Tuesday night, and that was, of course, nominated for the Animated Feature Oscar, and that'll play with some other animated shorts on Tuesday night.
So it's a pretty big festival, as usual. Any thematic element this year?
You know, we had a lot of female directors with films that won or got honorable mention or made it in, especially in the narrative feature category. Just a lot of women directors. I think that ceiling is starting to be pushed and shattered, you know, by Kathryn Bigelow and some others. And, of course, we have to talk about the trailblazers like Ida Lupino and Lena Wertmuller and Barbara Streisand and Jane Campion. But we're starting to see now with sort of these independent films, our director of Always Shine is a woman. That is the narrative feature winner. We're starting to see more and more female directors getting involved in filmmaking and getting their feet in the door. We really noticed it this year. It wasn't anything we, you know, planned for, but the films that came in that were good, a lot of them were directed by women directors.
Well, this festival, as you mentioned, has been around for a while now. It started in March of 2001. How many submissions this year?
Okay, I actually have that list right here. 301 films were submitted, 103 made it in. So you got about a one-third chance to make it into the screening, the official selection. The film festival circuit is tricky. You know, filmmakers really, a lot of them hang their hat on that, and that can lead to distribution. And we've seen that with some of our narrative feature films, Doug, where after we got them in the festival, there was a time frame, a time lapse where all of a sudden they got distribution like Always Shine, our narrative feature winner. That has distribution now. And we see that if they do well in the circuit, a company might come in and say, we want to release this in independent art house cinemas or whatever like that. So about one third actually make it from juring process into official selection. So it's hard to get in film festivals.
Well, that's interesting in its own right, because 300 plus films, you got to look at them. How is this done?
It actually works better than you might think it works. A few years ago, at a meeting, Greg Carlson and I and Emily Beck and some others suggested that because we had gone to what's called an online screening system, it's called Without a Box and also Film Freeway. This means that you can submit your films online through a platform. You don't have to mail in DVDs anymore. And us as jurors can watch them at our computer or wherever we need to watch them. But with the Without a Box Film Freeway platforms, our submissions went up a lot. And so we needed what's called pre-screening. So what we do on some of the fairly voluminous categories like narrative feature, documentary feature, narrative short, and student, they tend to get a lot of films submitted. We have pre-screening committees. Now, these are typically made up of long-standing volunteers at the festival. We're supposed to know what we're doing, but everyone has disagreements from now and again. And typically, three people will watch a film during pre-screening. And if it gets two yes votes, it goes through to the full jury. So there were over 60 narrative feature films, Doug, entered in this festival. That's a lot of work.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work for our nine jurors on that festival.
Figure a couple of hours per film.
Yep. So myself and a couple others, three or four other people, did some pre-screening. And that's trying to weed out the ones that just aren't good enough. And so there is a kind of a trust process that goes into that between those of us doing that. And after the pre-screening, the 61 narrative feature films that were submitted got down to about 30, okay? So then the full jury had to watch 30. Now, by that time, I had seen a lot of these because I was pre-screening. And from the 30, it got down to 12 that actually made it in the festival.
Wow.
So it actually works a little bit better than you might think it would with all those films.
Well, it's the Fargo Film Festival. I know you've had lots of national and international submissions, but what's the rough ratio of local or regional? How would you characterize that?
There's always, I would say, 3 to 5 maybe regional films per category. Now, sometimes, like with experimental, there aren't as many, especially with student. We still see a lot of student films come through from Minnesota State Moorhead and some other platforms, some other colleges around the area. Narrative feature, probably a little less. Narrative feature films are difficult to do. You have a lot of actors and sometimes SAG actors, and sometimes that can get a little unwieldy to do that on a small budget. But we do get regional and local films in. We have to evaluate them just as any other film that might come from L.A. or Great Britain or whatever.
Well, the Fargo Film Festival is in its 17th year, and it's a popular event. How many people are we expecting?
I'm not as good in the attendance figures as Emily Beck is, but it's in the thousands for sure that we get coming through. And ticketing, you can buy various passes, Doug, to get to all the pre-parties and all the sessions. I would encourage people to take advantage of that pass if you've got most of the week off.
That's about $100, isn't it?
Yeah, something like that. Maybe a little less. And I do know that our attendance records have consistently gone up. Our attendance figures have consistently gone up over the years.
Well,
so that's good.
Let's talk about some of these other things you get if you have a pass, mm-hmm. for example, these networking opportunities, these panel discussions. Talk about the sort of the structure of the day.
So we have three lunch panel discussions, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. I sort of organize these. Thursday at noon, these are at Dempsey's, by the way. They've opened up their side room for us. It's called Real Life Meets Cinema. That's the Thursday panel, and I will be moderating that one. And that's sort of like true stories on film. Chris Brown, the director of The Other Kids, which is sort of an interesting narrative feature. It's sort of half narrative feature, half docudrama. You're not sure if the kids in the films are really actors or if they're real kids. So that's an interesting one. And Melina Tupa, who directed The Search, is also on that panel. And Melina's film, The Search, is a great student film about all those people that disappeared in Argentina back in the 1970s. The Friday panel, moderated by the great Margie Bailey, is called Intimate Portraits, Personal Stories on Film. These are films by filmmakers that are really kind of autobiographical films. Serena Dykman is here. She directed Nana, the doc feature winner, and that is about her grandmother, who was a Holocaust survivor. Katie Grannon, who is attached to the documentary The Nine, which is about these kind of low-income people that live in Modesto, California, and that's a really interesting documentary. You really get a slice of life that you're not familiar with. And we have someone here attached to the experimental winner, Gratis, which is about people dealing with mental illness, and those are real actors, real people they're using in that. The Saturday panel is called Short and Sweet, exploring the short-form documentary and narrative, and Janet Hawk Brandau is moderating that one. And these, just like it says, these are people that did narrative short films or documentary short films.
And these luncheons, if you have that pass, the luncheon, is that part of the deal?
I think it's separate from the pass.
Okay.
But please check the Fargo Theater for that. I believe it's separate now from the pass.
And there are pre-parties before the evening shows, correct?
Yes, this comes with your pass. Tuesday night will be at the Hodo. Wednesday, Prairie Den. These start at 5:30, by the way. Thursday is at Drecker. Friday, back at the Prairie Den, and Saturday night is Etche. That usually has our finale. That's a nice place to have that.
And there'll be lots of filmmakers there to kind of rub shoulders with, correct?
Yes. I enjoy meeting the filmmakers, Doug, because you get a sense of the business, the sense of the industry, the sense of what these people go through to get a film made, and most of them have real, like, this isn't their complete job. They oftentimes, let me give you an example, Mike Flanagan, who now directs big-budget horror films. He's been to our festival a couple times, and the first time he came, his day job was editing reality television. Well, now Mike has made it big. He's a good friend of Tom Brandau's. They go way back to Tom's days in Baltimore. And there's an example of a guy who came to the festival with a short film, and now he's directed Oculus and some other pretty big horror films. So I just enjoy meeting these people, getting a different perspective of their life in L.A. or New York or Great Britain or wherever they're coming from.
Well, that local connection you mentioned earlier, Jeff Schlossman with The Hero this year,
yes,
the Friday night feature, they had the, like, was it the Brass Teapot or something? Was that?
Yes.
That kind of caught on. That's been shown quite a bit now.
They showed that at the festival. That did very well. He's produced I'll See You in My Dreams with Blythe Danner,
yes,
and Sam Elliott. That was last year. So he really has taken a career switch, Jeff has, and gone into filmmaking, and he really loves it. And he's met a lot of interesting people. And they really have a nice relationship with Blythe Danner and Sam Elliott with their company. We were sure hoping to get Sam here. Schedules didn't work out. We definitely try. I want to mention to people, we definitely try to get name actors to come with these films. Sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't. Another film I want to mention, Doug, that people may want to see is The Master Cleanse. This is a narrative feature official selection, and it stars Johnny Galecki, who is Leonard in The Big Bang Theory.
Yes.
The co-stars are Oliver Platt and Oscar winner Angelica Houston. This is a wonderful, strange film that Galecki produced with his own company.
Now, there are lots of opportunities for film students, too. You've suggested that. Some of them submit their films, obviously, but they're performers. This is a real opportunity for newcomers.
It's an opportunity to get your film screened in a mid-range film festival. I mean, the Fargo Film Festival, we've had Oscar-nominated films here, Oscar-winning films, famous directors like Hal Hartley and Guy Madden have been here. So you can put this on your resume, and if you go to IMDb pages, you can see this person is best actress. I'm not going to reveal who that is. That'll be revealed soon at the Fargo Film Festival. So it counts as an award. It counts as an official selection on your screening credits, whether you're a director, writer, or actor.
One of those invited films this year is Off the Chain, produced by directed by a familiar name.
I think it's called Off the Wall, On the Chain.
On the Wall, Off the Chain,
And that's Greg Carlson. And Greg is also getting the Ted Larson Award this year. And I know Greg is pretty thrilled to get that. He had a relationship with Ted way back in the days when he was a student. And, of course, as you know, Doug, Ted was at that first ever meeting way back when. I think it was out at Rocking Horse Farm.
It was.
And Margie was there, and myself, and Greg was there, and Ted was there before his untimely death. And so this was really, I think the Fargo Film Festival was really a dream of Ted and Margie and some other folks. Marty Jonasson was there. And so for Greg to get this award is a big deal. Greg's made a lot of really interesting short films in recent years that have screened at a lot of important competitions and important festivals. I really liked his film last year about Dean Syme, who's a big record collector. And these are just 6-7 minute films that Greg does with his producing partners and Tucker Lucas, who always shoots and edits those for Greg. So we're excited that Greg's going to get that award, and I know it means a lot to him.
Well, he teaches at Concordia as well. So we've got this kind of film community here that you wouldn't expect necessarily in a town the size of Fargo-Moorhead.
We do, and Tom Brandau makes very good films. He teaches at Morehead State, Minnesota State University, Morehead. And, you know, I know Greg has some interesting classes over there. You can take a class on Wes Anderson films. And Greg's been nice enough to hire me as an adjunct over there with some TV type classes. So there is a wealth of knowledge here. Kaya Christensen Nelson over at MSUM is a great experimental filmmaker. She's had films entered in big festivals. So, you know, you can meet these people too at the festival that actually live, write, and work among us.
Well, you've suggested the Fargo Film Festival Awards. How are they awarded?
The Best in Show Awards, Doug, are awarded through a special committee. That's about 12 or 13 people. They're typically jury chairs and executive committee members. So what happens is if a film wins documentary feature like Nana did, then it goes into what's called the Best in Show kind of, you know, hat. And then we all look at these films that come from various committees. Now, some committees may suggest Best Actor and Actress nominees. Those typically, of course, come from the narrative juries. They don't come from documentary juries. And then we get together and we vote. And that's how the Best in Show Awards are given out. Now, the Ted Larson Award, things like that, are typically decided by the executive committee. Very similar to the Oscars, where like the Board of Governors will say, you know, Peter O'Toole needs an honorary Oscar. So that's not voted on by the full Academy. It's voted on by about 20 or 25 people that sit on the Oscar Board of Governors. So we try to determine which awards are representative of a film, you know, the Independent Spirit Award, the Margie Bailey Volunteer Spirit Award, and we try to get together and award those as we see fit.
How does the award look? I mean, the Oscar is iconic, you know, and South Dakota's Film Festival's got a pretty interesting looking award now that looks like it's somewhat iconic.
They're nice plaques is what they are, basically. And so they look nice. They're nice to have on the mantle. And I invite people to come out and see who these award winners are.
Let's talk about the budget. This is not an inexpensive thing to put on. And, of course, you charge people to attend. So how much?
There's fundraising that goes on. We try to get sponsors. I want to mention Forum Communications and Bell Bank. They have been tremendous sponsors over the years for us, and they've really stepped up to the plate. And it does cost money to come. This is the biggest fundraiser for the Fargo Theater every year. So it does pay the bills, keeps the lights on at the Fargo Theater.
Great.
That's very, very important because, you know, this happens 5 days out of the year. But it's an important moneymaker for the festival, and it does. It does cost money. We have to make budget decisions, Doug, in terms of if someone wants to come, you know, with especially with winning filmmakers. We try to put them up at the Radisson. We try to pay for plane flights, things like that. We can't do all of that, but those become budgetary decisions, how much we can we afford to bring a special guest in. Sometimes there's a stipend that has to be paid for a Hal Hartley or a Guy Madden or John Waters or somebody like that. We have to kind of go through those budgetary decisions. Is this worth it? You know, when Kevin Smith came, you know, that did cost some money, but we felt it was worth it and it filled up the theater.
Okay. Now, formats have been changing over the years. Many years ago, film festivals were film, 16-millimeter or 35-millimeter. What about now?
That's very rare. We occasionally will get a 16 or 35-millimeter print in that they want to run that way, but typically it all comes through a digital file. That's how it's done these days. Most films are shot digitally now. They're shot on high definition. It's not film like you think of film, Doug. It's not, you know, David Lean sitting there splicing together film in an edit booth somewhere. It's most things are edited on Final Cut Pro or Adobe or Premiere, you know, editing systems like that. So That's the formats have changed, but you're still watching a theatrical movie.
And the schedule of the Fargo Theater, which is usually evenings, is changing this week. So when are the morning, the afternoon, and the evening showings?
So it all starts with Tuesday afternoon, and people can start watching films at 2 p.m. at both theaters. So you have the main venue, Doug. That's the big theater when you first come into the theater. And then off-Broadway, where you go down the hallway, that's a little more of an intimate setting. At nighttime, though, the night sessions are only in the main venue. So at night, they will be running normal Fargo Theater films in Theater 2.
Oh, I got you.
Pretty much things start at 10 a.m. every morning and run through the evening.
All right. The Fargo Film Festival, it starts Tuesday. It runs through Saturday. It's a big deal if you love movies. Thanks, Matt O'Lean.
Thanks, Doug.
More Main Street in a moment.
This is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public. There are some new programs we are trying, and I'd appreciate your comments. Saturdays at 2 Central, it's The Pulse, with all kinds of stories about people and health, innovation, and science. Then the next couple of Sundays at 5 p.m. Central, we're trying a show called With Good Reason, where scholars explore the worlds of literature, science, arts, politics, history, and business with the ever-curious host Sarah McConnell. And then on Wednesday nights at 8, here is a fun one, Away with Words, about language examined through history, culture, and family. It's lively and upbeat talk with callers from around the world about slang and grammar and old sayings and word origins and regional dialects, family expressions, and speaking and writing well. Write to me at bthomas@prairiepublic.org or call 800-359-6900 with your evaluation. Thanks.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. March is Women's History Month, and we found stories to tell that fit each day of the month. Today, we'll hear about Mary Ann Talbot, an English woman who wore male clothing to become a sailor during the Napoleonic Wars.
Welcome to the Fair Sex Calendar, where today in history, women make the news. This is in celebration of Women's History Month for the 31 days of March. True stories of women who chose to rock boats as well as cradles. Many are names you haven't heard of until author Vicki Leone brings their deeds to vivid life.
March 20th, 1792. London orphan Mary Ann Talbot sails for the Caribbean today, dressed as a manservant and called John Taylor by her abusive master. This is the first of many adventures that cross-dressing Mary will have. During the Napoleonic Wars, she serves in the British Navy as well as the Army. Mary sees frontline action as a drummer boy, and later, as a powder monkey, she nearly loses a leg. Mary then spends 18 months as a prisoner of war, and later serves a stretch in debtor's prison. Undismayed, she travels the world and alternates between genders, trying her luck at a variety of occupations from actress to highwayman. She gets romanced by a gal in North America, gets taken to court on two continents, and gets into scrapes everywhere. You won't be surprised to learn that Talbot dies in her 30s, pretty much worn out by her pursuit of the untamed life.
These and other true tales of outrageous women who refuse to button up or back down are drawn from the books by historical detective Vicki Leone. The newest of her 9 nonfiction titles on women's history is 4,000 Years of Uppity Women. Visit VickiLeone.com for more on her books, including ebook editions. Our theme music is by Cafe Musique. That Schoenberg Rag by Larry Unger.
Tomorrow's Women's History Month story will feature a very well-known name, Pocahontas.
The HMS Erebus and a sister ship left England in 1845 to find the Northwest Passage. They were never seen again until a team of Canadian searchers discovered the wreckage in the Arctic 3 years ago. Journalist Paul Watson saw it happen.
I wasn't expecting anything to happen. And when they did make a discovery, you know, it really seeps into your blood.
We'll have that conversation on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning right here on Prairie Public. This is Dakota Datebook for March 20th. Modern-day people take street pavement for granted, driving over concrete highways and asphalt streets. But back in the 1890s, the going was tougher. North Dakota's towns had dirt roads or hard-packed soil that could turn into sticky mud during a good rain, becoming impassable. One early approach involved wood block paving, cut from logs and circular in shape. In 1895, the Fargo City Council approved cedar block paving for sections of Front, Northern Pacific, and Broadway streets. And on this date in 1896, newspapers reported that Fargo City Council had approved paving an additional section of Broadway all the way to 12th Avenue North. Workers prepared the roadbeds by scraping them level and packing the dirt with heavy street rollers. Next, they added a layer of sand for drainage. Wooden planks covered the sand, followed by round cedar blocks. Finally, workers tamped sand and gravel into all the crevices, making a smooth, regular surface suitable for horses, bicycles, carriages, and heavy wagons. These circular blocks were typically 4 to 9 inches wide and 4 to 8 inches deep. Cedar was chosen for its low initial cost and its resistance to rotting. And so, Fargo proudly paved its downtown and nearby residential streets. But then, disaster happened. In the spring of 1897, the worst flood yet struck the town. Flood water gushed over the new paving and undermined the foundation. The water pushed up cedar blocks, sweeping them into the swirling Red River. The blocks floated away to the north, up the Red River Valley, through Grand Forks, all the way to Canada, past Winnipeg, and into Hudson Bay. More than 10 city blocks of wooden pavement floated north on the Red, and another 6 city blocks were so washed out that the cedar pieces had to be collected and painstakingly reinstalled. Fargo spent $50,000 to fix the damage, and by 1899 boasted that it had 10 miles of cedar block streets. But by 1910, the cedar paving had deteriorated badly, and Fargo replaced its wooden blocks with brick, asphalt, or concrete. Even though North Dakota cities have put the age of impossibly muddy streets behind them, the difficult climate still puts bumps into the road. Continual freezing and thawing this time of the year torments drivers with pothole season. Today's Dakota Date Book was written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Date Book is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
Tuesday on Main Street, the Williston Police Department had to grow quickly to meet the challenges associated with the oil boom. And to help residents understand more about the work they do, the department will hold a Citizens Police Academy next month. We'll talk about it with Lieutenant Detective Amy Nikoloff on Main Street tomorrow. We hope you can join us for that. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.